unarmed mental health worker shot by police. Miscommunication and misunderstanding around the man with autism he was trying to help.
Taken to Parker, he's bipolar schizophrenia. Make sure they train police officers.
Okay.
Responding to a 911 call about a bipolar schizophrenic man off his meds.
Drop it!
Yay!
Drop it!
Yay! Don't you, don't you.
Bravo, seven, drop it!
Shots fired. Cover code 3.
The training that these guys are lacking is what needs to be changed.
Jason Harrison's name has now become one among many others. Names like Laval Hall, Dontre Hamilton, and James Boyd, Americans described by their families as mentally ill, who've ended up on the wrong side of an officer's gun. Many even inside law enforcement are calling this a crisis in American policing.
Welcome to Off Baseline. I'm Nate Staley. In this episode, I talk with a licensed social worker and community mental health liaison, Jen Gentry, about mental health awareness in policing. We discuss the many challenges of dealing with police work, having to carry a vast knowledge of mental health symptoms and issues and identifying what they look like and how they're manifested with in crisis situations and instant on your feet moments of life-threatening situations with minimal training historically on the topic, as well as built-in systemic and historical issues that tie in as well. So, fascinating conversation. Looking forward to it. That's to follow, but first, thanks for listening to Off Baseline. We've officially passed the 500 download mark, which is a nice initial milestone for where we're at. So, thanks to everyone who has downloaded this show from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, or wherever. I appreciate you. Catch the show on Twitter at OffBaseline or at NateCaseyMO. Find the show on the Facebook. You can help the show by also writing a review on iTunes. So lots of things you can do. Once again, thanks for listening so far. Appreciate the feedback and the support. So before we begin, a quick word on suicide. With the recent celebrity suicides of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, we're faced with perhaps the unpleasant and unprepared for the reality that many people we know in our lives may be dealing with something harder than we're aware of, or something we even might know how to handle. Maybe it's something you've been dealing with yourself and you don't feel like things will ever really change, or you're not getting the support that you need. If that's you right now, be open and reach out to someone in your life, whether it's someone close or maybe someone not close, but someone you respect or would trust with a serious conversation. You may be surprised by how much people care and how needed you are in the world. You can call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline 24 hours a day. Doesn't matter what time of day it is, at 1-800-273-8255. Or you can text TALK WITH US to 66746. That's TALK WITH US to 66746. If calling someone on the phone is unlikely, but a text may be something you can do. Reach out to a therapist or local community mental health center, because if finances are a concern, and they're a very realistic concern a lot of the time, they'll find a way to get you the help you need in the moment regardless. Just your life has value, even when the temporary thoughts and feelings obscure your perspective to see it. If you're a loved one, a friend, or a colleague wanting to support or concerned about somebody, just know that it may be difficult for you to talk about it, but it will be an enormous relief for someone who is dealing with suicidal thoughts to realize that someone cares and will be there, can handle it, and that they're needed in your life. It's a challenging, so providing those ideas, those thoughts, is challenging a thought system within the illness of depression and suicide, you know, challenging that narrative, that those beliefs, I am alone, it's hopeless, it'll never change, it'll never get better, I'm a burden to everyone. Know that talking about suicide directly, bringing it up specifically, will not give them an idea, but statistics have shown that it can decrease chances really just by asking, by what we've talked about. So build supports, make sure there's plenty of support, whether that's people, whether that's organizations, whether that's coping skills, if there's a weapon or something like that, a gun, make an agreement about a safe place to remove or store those for a necessary period of time. And oftentimes just asking, what can I do for you? Above all, just know that you don't need to have all the answers for somebody. That might even help you connect. Oftentimes, we need to know that we're not alone in the confusion and the chaos. Next on the show, my interview with Jen Gentry about police forces and community mental health. Joining me on the program is a licensed clinical social worker and a colleague of mine in her role as a community mental health liaison, Jen Gentry. Welcome to Off Baseline.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for taking me up on the invite.
Of course. Happy to do it.
I'm pretty excited to have you on to talk about what you do, because it correlates with a very hot button issue in, you know, with how police interact with, you know, society, and also how mental health plays into that. So I guess just start out, tell us a little bit about your background and what role you play with your job and in community mental health.
Sure. So I work specifically with law enforcement and courts in the 9 Northwest counties of Missouri. And in that role, I serve to help connect people to resources, mental health or substance use resources, or both. You know, so I do some of that direct service work in serving that capacity, mm-hmm. but I also do mental health training with law enforcement, go into different departments, and we'll train on just a variety of different topics related to mental health, whatever they kind of feel like is needed at the time. And then kind of on a larger scale, we have really worked to get our crisis intervention team program up and going in our area. And that is a pretty big collaboration between law enforcement and providers and consumer advocates to really put our resources together and figure out what's out there and how those resources are changing over time. But also to really highlight some of the system issues that we have to see what we can do about that. So I also try to, you know, kind of smooth out those processes if we can, so that we are making our best efforts at getting people into the services that they're needing and not creating barriers simply because we're not communicating well enough and not addressing some of those little things that end up being such a big deal to people getting their needs met.
Yeah. So, what would be maybe an example of kind of a little thing that might be a communication breakdown or something that might be missed between different agencies?
So, you know, the whole reason that my position was created was that law enforcement are the people that get called in when somebody has a crisis. So, you know, somebody's in a mental health crisis, they get called out. And we've had situations where, you know, somebody was suicidal or they have made a suicide attempt, had a situation where someone had written a note. And so, and they had cut their throat. And then they had been transported to the hospital. Law enforcement then fills out the appropriate paperwork to, you know, help start that involuntary hold process. And they were admitted onto the mental health unit. And I was looking at our notes from our staff who attend the mental health meeting every day on the mental health unit. And it said, unclear if this was a suicide attempt. And I'm have the paperwork in front of me. I have a copy of the suicide note, and I, you know, I'm going, where have we gone wrong here? Where something has gone terribly awry. If this information has not made it to the appropriate people who are, you know, in this role of trying to help this person. So, you know, it's such a small thing, but, and, you know, just that communication piece. I think sometimes in the moment that, you know, we all get kind of caught up in what's going on and, you know, also trying to do our part, but then hand it off to somebody else. And sometimes those little details, get lost in the shuffle. And I'm not really sure, you know, in that instance, you know, I reached out and I said, you know, hey, very clear that this was a suicide attempt. Have you seen the note? And it was unclear where the note was. Not really sure if it didn't get handed off, if it got lost in the shuffle of paperwork.
Jeez, yeah. So things weren't tracked and...
So, you know, I'm really trying to just identify some of those little things, and sometimes it's just a one-time issue that needs to be addressed, and sometimes it's some of those, like, ongoing things that we're continuously trying to you know, get at.
Yeah, and I read something, can you saying that reminded me of, it was, I can't remember if it was the Chicago Tribune or whatever it was. It basically talked about, police are basically society's safety net for mental illness. Because we prioritize it so little, just broadly speaking, compared to other things, that we maybe do or fund, so little that, the funding to properly deal with the amount of people, who are mentally ill and maybe psychotic or having suicidal, homicidal thoughts or acting on them. You know, it's so scarce that we don't have enough resources to address the problem head on. So, you know, it really just falls all the way down to, you know, we call the police to deal with these emergencies and clean up the mess. And, you know, in large part, probably more is falling onto their plates than perhaps is fair. What's is expected?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think this goes back to even, you know, the closing down of state hospitals and releasing people into the communities and where there weren't enough resources. And then You know, I mean, of course, people who have untreated mental health are going to have more mental health crises, and who is there to deal with that but law enforcement, you know? One of my law enforcement friends says, we don't get called to the birthday party unless someone gets stabbed with the cake knife. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're not getting called out for the best of things, only the worst. So, you know, they're having these crises, and they're the ones who are on call. And, you know, that's still true today as it was decades ago, unfortunately. And, you know, I mean, I think it highlights so many different issues, you know, that
right.
defunding mental health has a huge impact on the amount of calls law enforcement receives that are mental health related. But then we also have a large number of people who are in a profession who are responding to these calls who are not trained to do that.
Right.
And that issue is also being addressed. You know, I mean, we're making huge efforts to reach out and provide that some kind of mental health mm-hmm. training for them. And we've made great strides in that regard. But, you know, I mean, we are falling to people who didn't get into mental health work. They got right. into law enforcement. And so, you know, inevitably they are then not as available to respond to criminal activity, mm-hmm. of course, because
right.
they are dealing with a lot
from,
of mental health stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's taken away from other, you know, potential calls that they could be on. And,
right.
And you're right. There's a ton of variables to consider. Whether it's, you know, education and, you know, mental health funding, whether it's specific proven initiatives, whether it's basic levels of education and training. And, you know, part of that it seems like is something that you're pretty heavily involved with on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then there's, you know, you hear about all these cases and just more generally with, you know, when we're talking about police and you know, there's a case of, you know, you just do a 5-minute Google search or a YouTube search and you'll see something where something went horribly wrong or something, you know, like specifically even involving people who are mentally ill. There's a ton of examples out there of things just completely going wrong. You know, I think of this, I remember this one video, I think it's out of Florida. I can't remember if he was a caseworker or some other care provider. But he was lying on the ground next to his, the client who was like a 23-year-old, highly autistic client who was, just kind of sitting up there, just kind of, just playing with a toy or something. And you know, the police are kind of yelling at him to lie on the ground and he's trying to, you know, the caseworker or the care provider is lying on the ground trying to explain what's going on. And, you know, there's not really, that information isn't really being relayed and, you mm-hmm. know, no one's doing what the police are asking. They wind up shooting the caseworker in the leg. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and you see situations like that and you know, there's that pressing question even more so of what variables do we need to consider in that scenario? Is it, you know, is it the things we talked about? Is it some type of toxic environment of like shoot first, you know, kind of aggression thing, you know, like it's a messy thing and, I don't know what sticks out to you when those types of situations, when you see them.
Well, I think this is truly where CIT came from. You know, it was developed out of Memphis based on, you know, situations just like that. Mm-hmm. And the community came together saying, we have got to do something, to better educate law enforcement. So they know, you know, how to help, folks who are in some kind of behavioral health crisis, and they, you know, have some framework to base that off of. So, you know, I think that at this point, that has been one of the most successful programs. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it provides not only mental health education for law enforcement, but it also ties in education from other officers who come in and teach how do you utilize the mental health education in your day-to-day work? How do you employ de-escalation skills mm-hmm. so that when you're interacting with someone, you're not escalating them, you're not triggering them, but also you're honing in on certain symptoms, certain tips that person is giving you that, you know, kind of slows down that mental process and makes you go, oh, wait a minute, I think there might be something more going on here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that is the trick, though. Because when they go through the academy, and like I said, this is changing, but when they go through the academy, most of the time they don't get much mental health education. And so you're really talking about shifting that mindset and pumping the brakes a little bit to really evaluate those symptoms that you're observing. So, you know, as an example, when a lot of officers see someone who is manic, they automatically think they have been using meth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they very well might have. I mean, we have to admit that most of the time it takes some time to figure that out.
Right.
Is this, you know, because of a substance, or is this due to mental health, or is it a little of A and B? And so, you know, we're asking somebody who really isn't formally trained to try and decipher that. And that can be really, really tricky.
Right. I mean, how long is the, so you mentioned the academy. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, I don't have a particularly, good kind of understanding of how long that is necessarily.
And, you know, truly, I don't know how long the academy is either, but mm-hmm. I have been told that, you know, at most you get about a day's worth of mental health education. And some academies are doing a better job now of addressing that and trying yeah. to incorporate more mental health education. So, right.
Which might be more than even used. It might be even more than they used to have. I mean, a day's worth might, you know, factoring that right. in.
Right. Absolutely. So, and there's been a lot of talk, you know, do we incorporate the 40-hour CIT training into the academy? A lot of departments wait until somebody has been, you know, with them a few years before they send them through CIT training. So, it, you know, it just kind of depends, but, you know, more often than not, when they're starting out, I mean, they just have so little information to go off of. So, we're trying to provide just an entirely different framework for them to operate from. And usually, you know, when we have officers come through CIT, they're able to provide us such a wealth of examples of situations that they have been in. And you know, it really helps them understand what that looks like, what this, you know, there's the information in theory, but what this actually looks like mm-hmm. in the community. When you're seeing someone who is manic, when you're seeing someone who is psychotic, you know, what does that look like in real life? And when you're having a conversation with them, how does that play out? What are some of those things that you can use in conversation to build that quick rapport and de-escalate them, so, you know, we can keep everybody as safe as possible? And that yeah. truly is the main goal. Right. You know, we want the individuals who are in crisis to be safe, and we also want officers to be safe. And I always tell them, unfortunately, sometimes the uniform works against you. There's a reason that I don't have to carry a gun when I go out and I see people in the community, because I don't have a uniform, so I tend to not trigger people as much.
Right.
I don't have a weapon. That tends to not trigger people as much. So, you know, sometimes simply their presence alone can escalate someone. So they really have to work hard and utilize those skills to do what they can to bring them, you know, back down so you can actually have a productive conversation.
Yeah. Wait, you don't just run around carrying a weapon when you're providing mental health services? I don't know.
Right?
You might have missed the memo, but it's we're all supposed to be packing these days.
You know, and I've been told that so many times. Jen, you need to be packing everywhere you go. And
yeah,
you
know, Starbucks, I mean, McDonald's.
Right. And, you know,
way.
I mean, I do cover a large area and it is very rural. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I've found myself in Timbuktu, you know, kind of in the middle of nowhere where, you know, if something should happen, no one would probably find me for a very long time. So, you know, right. I get that there is a safety component of it that definitely needs to be acknowledged, but
sure.
I don't think it needs to be acknowledged.
Yeah,
with
I think it's safest if you have like 10 of them, you know, and you can just
right.
pull three of
right.
them out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we kind of hit at, you know, a lot of different angles here. The education one seems to be one of the biggest ones. You know, I'm just so the average police officer, that's pretty much, is it a high school? It's a high school education, right? And then the academy, and then you're in, or what's, help me understand that a little bit more, I guess.
Sure. So I believe that the requirement is 21.
Okay.
In order you just have to have a high school education. Now, you know, as people start moving through the ranks, of course, you know, it's like most fields, if you get a degree, that will help you move up quicker. But yeah, you just have to be 21 to be able to go through the academy, which, you know, as we're educating about brain development, you know,
right.
we always laugh
right.
about how shocking it is to think
right.
about where we were at 21. And
no kidding. I should have not been in charge of anybody's safety at 21.
No. And yet we're giving people a gun and a badge. But
right,
so.
Right. And we do it at 18 for the military, too, you know, so.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah. Brain development is a. You know, is an interesting point to bring up as far as, you know, the amount of stress and the amount of things that you're putting on someone's plate. And mm-hmm. we may not, you know, of course, we haven't been in the past asking ourselves, you know, what is, to use the phrase, developmentally appropriate to expect someone to process in a given situation. You know, I wouldn't expect, I wouldn't ask my 1.5-year-old to check and see if there are any cars, going by on the street that I'm backing out onto, you know, or
yeah.
just, you know, I like a, even when you're a teenager and a young adult, you know, it's certain elements of empathy and understanding, you know, more abstract, understanding of the world are still developing and, and, you know, and, so with education, I mean, should the, level of education be higher? Should there be different standards kind of structurally? Would that be something that, has been considered or could be considered or, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, you know, some of the academies are starting to incorporate CIT into that academy so that
yeah.
when they walk out the door, they do have some more of that education.
So walk us through CIT a little bit, I guess. So what does that
sure.
process look like when you're engaging, you know, utilizing the program to engage a crisis?
So So like I said, I mean, it's a 40-hour course. It's week long. And starting out at the beginning of the week, you just get some general mental health education about, you know, certain disorders that you're probably going to mm-hmm. see out there, substance use, you know, co-occurring right. disorders, you know, focusing on aging population, youth population, gets into medications just a little bit. And, you know, then we move through some of the specialty, like there's a section on autism and talking about vets. And then we start getting into the legal side of things, involuntary commitments. You know, what does that look mm-hmm. like? And we have a judge that teaches that, so you can actually talk to the man who makes the decisions, and what are they looking for, and what does statute say, and then, you know, really getting into the nitty gritty of de-escalation, and you know, what are those tools that you can utilize in those conversations? What's the liability when you're looking at diversity? What is that? What kind of an impact does that have right. on those interactions? And let's be real. I mean, Northwest Missouri is not known for being sure. a largely diverse community.
Right, right. Well, there's a diversity of predominantly one skin color. Yeah.
Sure. Exactly. You know, I mean, one of the things we really try to highlight in just that realm is, of course, you know, as social workers and you know, therapists and counselors, we're always focusing on our own biases, you know, and that's mm-hmm. something that we really highlight as we go through school, you know, and try to build up our own self-awareness. So, you know, that's something we try to do. You know, it's not necessarily just about skin color, but, you know, when you right. see the farmer in, you know, dirt and oil covered bib overalls, what's your gut reaction?
Right.
When you see somebody who's covered in tattoos and has, you know, bright purple hair, what's your gut reaction? Because, you know, certainly that taints our view of somebody. It you know, brings a certain energy to that interaction. So, you know, trying to highlight some of those things. They get a chance to do some role plays, which is always interesting. And, you know, I don't care what field you're in, nobody yeah. likes role plays. No,
yeah. Only weirdos like me enjoy throwing that into yeah. an educational environment.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, like there's just a select few. Yeah. But ultimately at the end of it, we always get the best feedback. We have a couple of panels that we utilize, a family panel, and a lived experience panel, you know, so they can get firsthand feedback of what it's like to live with a mental illness and mm-hmm. go through that process or a substance use disorder or both. And then lastly, we kind of rounded out talking about their own wellness, which is a hard topic, but very, very, very necessary. So, you know, we're asking them to take all of that with them. And then, you know, when they're out in those interactions, just being able to even approach them in a way that is not threatening or, you know, isn't perceived as being aggressive, but, you know, just being, you know, somewhat gentle. Obviously, mm-hmm. They're trying to make sure, you know, they're taking control of the situation, but, you know, and giving somebody the opportunity to talk about what exactly is going on, to be able to validate how they feel without agreeing with them. You know, I mean, I think yeah. that's one thing as clinicians
right.
that we do quite a bit of, you
that's
know,
like,
I mean,
literally
hey
my
man,
job.
I hear you. I hear where you're coming from. I don't necessarily agree, you know, I mean, and so, you know, trying to teach them to utilize some of those little tips.
Right. Cause the natural inclination, the natural inclination is to tell you what we're thinking, you know, as people,
yes.
right. Like as socially, you know, socialized in our culture. Yeah. We just tell you that we think you're wrong or something's not right.
Right. Or, you know, there's so many ways that we can relate to law enforcement that, you know, I mean, it's there's very similar experiences. And one of those is that most of us got into this work because we want to help people. And that's fantastic, except that in that means we're fixers. And so you know, then as
built-in
soon,
weakness.
Yes, as soon as somebody starts talking, our mind starts going about how are we going to fix this? So I try to train a lot on, okay, you have to gather good information before you're actually going to be able to do a good job of fixing the problem or even, you know, I mean, and most of the time you're not fixing it. You're just guiding people to resources. But even to do that well, you have to first be able to figure out what the problem is. And you can't do that well unless you're really listening.
Right.
So, you know, just slowing down that process of what kind of questions can you ask somebody to build that quick rapport? You know, maybe you're talking about things that they enjoy. Oftentimes they're in their home, in their rooms when they're, you know, having these conversations. Hey, look around you. Engage them in a conversation that's about something that they care about,
right,
to help build that quick rapport. And then start asking them, you know, I mean, they're telling you that this is the problem. This is what's going on. But our problems don't happen in a vacuum. So ask them about what else is going on in their life, because I can guarantee it's not just about that one thing. It's about 10 other things that
right.
are going on as well, or 10 other things that one big thing is affecting. So ask them about that. How are you dealing with everything? Do you have any support systems? You know, and just kind of digging in. And I try to frame it as, if I walked in here and I admitted guilt to a crime, that is not enough to sentence me. So you have to build a case up. You have to gather that information and let that information guide you to the end result. So, you know, and a lot of times we have people walk in and say, hey, this is what's going on. This is my crisis. And by the time you get done talking to them, you realize that the problem is something else entirely.
Right.
And, you know, I think that one of the big things we're trying to combat right now is that not every person who's in a mental health crisis needs to go to the hospital.
Sure.
And so, you know, just slowing down that process. If I say I'm going to kill myself, it does not mean an automatic straight ticket to the mental health unit
right.
at the closest hospital. You know, hey, get some more information, find out what's going on. They may feel a whole heck of a lot better after they get a chance to talk. They may be connected to resources that, you know, you could take them to. You could take them to their caseworker or to their therapist or their doctor, or that person might be able to come out to them. So, you know, really just trying to provide them with some other options and give them some of those tools that in the moment they can utilize, because, you know, the broad sweeping theories are great, but it's in those little, in the moments, those in the nitty gritty where things start to fall apart and where it matters most, because, you know, if they feel like the officer that's out there with them genuinely cares and wants to hear what's going on and wants to be helpful to them, oh, what a difference it makes.
Yeah, and
what a
counter narrative it may provide with what they're expecting, what they've heard, maybe even what they've experienced before, you know, from a previous traumatic experience.
Sure. Yeah, and we talk about that, you know, that every interaction you have is an opportunity to reshape that person's idea of law enforcement, because so many people are used to or have been taught to view law enforcement in simply a punitive way. And you know, I mean, I think culturally that really is across the board. I mean, when a cop pulls out behind me, my anxiety level goes up and I might not even be speeding. So,
right.
You know, it's just something that is so ingrained in us that you know, they really do have to do a lot more work to help somebody see, hey, you know, I really am here to help. But, you know, when I talk to people who interact with law enforcement regularly, some of those officers are a huge support to them. And they will talk about that. Gosh, like what a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in, you know, and I just keep getting back to the structural component of it too, and even thinking of historically, you know, we have this sort of maybe timeline or narrative in our minds of, you know, at some point police in the past have represented, you know, the face of the community, serve and protect, that sort of thing. You know, kind of the change in technology and how we consume media has, you know, shown us a very different side, and you know, it's tempting to think that it suddenly showed up, you know, like,
sure.
But has, you know, probably just been there, and it just happened to be videoed, and you know, it's not every, you know, it's not a majority of situations, but it definitely draws our attention. But even just, you know, thinking structurally from the punitive perspective of the force of law enforcement, as far as you know, the crisis intervention team, you're specifically doing things to educate, you're specifically doing things to bring their awareness to what symptoms maybe slow things down, what symptoms are they experiencing, what, you know, is this someone who's just being aggressive and trying to harm me or others, or is it a situation where, you know, they're perhaps hallucinating or using meth or other substances or whatever it is. I mean, that's a lot. Again, that's a lot to take in. But even just thinking from the 30,000 foot level, are you aware of any, are there any policies out there that maybe not our state, but other states have implemented, or police forces, or maybe one that hasn't been proposed yet, but that would make sense, like some type of reorganization of how everything is approached. You know, the CIT team is a good start, you know, definitely. Mm-hmm. Seems to me that, you know, it's quite a journey ahead of us to see where this is, you know, where we can improve this even further.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's been several different things I've seen. You know, I think that when I came into this job 5 years ago, when this job was created 5 years ago, you know, we just didn't know what it was going to look like.
Right.
And we didn't really know what our communities were needing and what was going on out there. And CIT was truly just really, I mean, in just a few areas, it was booming in Kansas City and St. Louis, but just in a few areas outside of that, there has been a tremendous effort statewide to expand it out, especially out to the rural communities. And so I'm really active on our state CIT council as well. And they're constantly talking about, you know, we have this map and everyone started out as a white county where there was no CIT, and the blue counties are where it's established and the yellow counties are where it's kind of working on getting going. And so they talk about, we're trying to turn the black map blue. And for the most part, I mean, we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And Missouri is, you know, trying to be a huge leader in that. And there has been support from the legislature. And so the Department of Mental Health, and they are now funding a position for, you know, a state CIT coordinator, so that it is this collaborative effort at the top, and they're going before legislature to testify before committees. So they're really providing the data that I collect and my colleagues do statewide, so they're accurately reflecting what's going on in the communities. you know, I think that the treatment courts, the diversion courts, mm-hmm. are another aspect of it that I think is pretty huge. I was at the International CIT conference a couple of years ago and heard a prosecuting attorney speak. And she was saying, I wish I could remember where she was from, but she was saying they have 7 diversion courts. And if you qualified for all 7 of those, they would send you through every single one of those diversion courts before they would even consider, you know, just the traditional punitive route.
Right. Which makes a huge difference. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's revolutionary. I mean, I have never heard of an area, you know, just really embracing this idea of how the legal system can take part in really helping people address what is actually going on that's creating all of these issues and helping them get stable through these partnerships of the legal system and, you know, community providers. So I think that we have a long way to go with that. You know, there's some areas where those diversion courts are really thriving. But for the most part, you know, we're still in the beginning stages of that.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's something that we could really focus on.
I was going to say, even just funding mental health, like, you know, I was thinking the other day of if mental health could extend their reach too, how much more that could prevent some of these things falling to police mm-hmm. in a crisis situation.
Sure. And so, you know, every year we go to the Hill to for our Hill Day and do advocacy. And so I've had the, you know, honor and fortune of being able to do that every year. And I take a sergeant with me because, you know, I mean, a social worker saying, hey, listen to us.
Right.
Our needs are important. You need to support this. Doesn't really speak as loudly mm-hmm. as an officer saying, you need to listen to these people because if you don't, and if you don't support the programs that they're providing and continue to, you know, build them up, we have to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
provide the authoritative police presence to validate. To cause this culture change that we need to happen where, you know, we don't pay deference to those mental health needs. And so maybe, you know, with police coming on board and saying, you know, maybe some of the same things and maybe something sticks.
Right, right. And, you know, I know that on the law enforcement side of things, they're really taking a look at what they can do differently too and thinking outside of the box. And, you know, I think that these collaborative relationships that we have built already are really allowing those ideas to take root a whole lot quicker than they would have in the past. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even just in our area, just this year, I was able to hire a clinician to be in our largest jail. And she's embedded there every single day, or Monday through Friday. You know, she's able to provide crisis assessments. She's able to talk to people who are on medication about, you know, how they're going to continue that. Who are they going to follow up with after they get released? She's able to do intakes for our office. So, you know, Even some of this is largely based on who is in charge at the time. You know, the previous administration never would have even considered it, you know, and now there was a change. And so their focus has turned to how can we make this jail more rehabilitative,
mm-hmm.
Which is also a huge shift that is happening, but needs to happen more so as well. But, you know, because we had this relationship already built up, the jail was totally on board with letting us put one of our staff in there. And you know, the feedback has been nothing but positive so far. We're talking about trying to embed a person that would be, you know, just like me in my same role, but they would be embedded in our largest department. And they would, you know, go out on those calls in the moment and talk with people. So, you know, as we have seen this level of need rise, I think these relationships have really allowed us to have some conversations about, hey, let's dream and scheme about what we need and what can this look like.
Yeah.
And where do we need to focus our efforts and focus our dollars to really address what's actually going on?
Right. To even envision and imagine and plan for, okay, you know, hopefully in this world where, you know, like we're rearranging scraps right now, but just imagine for a moment we get some real funding, some real permanent funding. What kind of position can we create that, you know, can really sort of solve a lot more of these problems? And that's a great, you know, that's a great idea and example that that you provided there, you know, providing someone embedded.
And there are more funding opportunities coming available, specifically focusing in on mental health and the Justice Department, you know, I mean, and how those two factions interact and, you know, what can we do to address things on all fronts there? So, you know, I truly think that that comes from law enforcement stepping up and really embracing their roles as advocates as well. My position was specifically created because law enforcement stepped up and said, hey, we don't have anybody out here. So, you know, I mean, those voices are being heard. And so some of those funding opportunities are coming available that would not have been available to us had we not been really honing in on how are we collectively going to work to resolve these issues. And it's been interesting when I started my job, you know, one of the big selling points was, hey, I'm here to help address these issues so you can do more law enforcement work. And my chief of my biggest department said, this is law enforcement work. This is what law enforcement work looks like now. And he wasn't bitter about it. You know, it was just very matter of fact. And you know, I mean, I really appreciate just the acknowledgement of that, that, you know, this isn't, there's not these clear cut lines of this is mental health work and this is law enforcement work and the two don't intersect.
Nope. Yeah.
There is a ton of overlap there. And truthfully, you know, I mean, in the moment, when I'm out on calls with people, you know, it's such a great, just a great setup because some people really interact better with non-law enforcement. So therefore, maybe I'm more effective in those conversations. But I've also had situations where people don't want anything to do with me. And sometimes that's because they've had negative interactions with mental health, or sometimes it's been because I'm a woman. And so then whoever the law enforcement is that's with me has been able to step in and totally take over that conversation, you know, and lead it in the exact same direction I would have taken it. But so, you know, it really does work to our benefit for, you know, both parties to be there. And then when you go to the 30,000 foot view, you know, like I said, you know, when we're at those hill days, sometimes, you know, our voices just don't necessarily reach to the level that where we're getting something done. And as an example, you know, we were there a couple of years ago and one of the legislators, his staff said, he's on the floor. He's not coming off. He's not talking to anybody. Well, we knew that he had been former law enforcement as well. So we go to the door guy. And our sergeant slips him his card, goes and gives it to the representative. And 2 minutes, here he comes off the floor. He's talking to us, you know, and I mean, it just changed that whole opportunity for a conversation that we just wouldn't have had.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it really is proving to be pretty vital to have both parties there in the direct care, but all the way up to the top as well.
Yeah, and like you said, you're blurring that line. Basically, Jen, you're getting rid of, you're spoiling that age-old excuse of, it's not my job.
You know, right.
To be able to say that. So.
Right. Geez. Yes. Which, you know, I mean, there's always going to be some of that. But, you know, I mean, you were talking about the media and how, you know, I mean, they are, I shouldn't say they, there's some people are very eager to highlight those negative, awful cases where, you know, I mean, it's sexy to have blood, guts, and gore out there,
right,
and to have a villain.
Right. And to be fair, we should separate out some of the, you know, talking about being prepared to deal with a mental health situation versus maybe some of the structural racism that we've been grappling with as a society as well. There's a couple of different, you know, angles,
yes,
to that whole debate, even when you, you know, get to the debate. But yeah,
right.
The refrain is to try not to over vilify, because that's not really going to provide viable solutions for anybody.
No, it's not. And truly, I mean, in my work, I have been so encouraged and so inspired to see law enforcement who, you know, I say they're oftentimes social workers in a uniform, because they just do such incredible work and they get it.
Right.
They really get it.
Well, and you said they suggested some of these things that you're doing to help them. They made the suggestions to you to provide that information. So that's,
yeah,
when you say they get it, they really, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, I mean, sometimes you look at all of those stories in the media and you look at the level of need and you know, it is easy to get really, you know, just really discouraged by that. And then you see some of those interactions and you go, no, I really think that we are headed in the right direction. And I think that we're doing good work out there. I know we are. I'm seeing it. And that's really pretty incredible. So, you know, it's just a matter of building on those things. But, you know, I appreciate what you're saying about, you know, there just being different aspects of, mm-hmm, you know, what's going on with law enforcement and some of those interactions. And, you know, I always try to highlight, hey, you know what, there's some pretty shitty social workers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, that's not the majority of us, but there's some pretty awful ones and there's some pretty awful cops out there. And that's not the majority of them, but, mm-hmm, you know, who ends up on the news? So, you know, I mean, we really try to also do what we can to highlight the really positive work that's happening to build that up.
Right.
As well.
Right. And when we
also acknowledge, like, hey, you know what? Like, CIT is intended to give you some other tools, but it does not mean that you abandon everything related to safety. Because the second someone is pointing a gun at you,
yeah,
you flip back into that training, and you're probably going to shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's certainly scenarios in stories in which we've heard people have opted not to do that, and they've been able to talk somebody down, and that's phenomenal. But I cannot, in good conscience, advocate that any of my officers go out and put themselves in a situation where they might not go home that night because they've decided to, you know, put their safety training to the side and, you know, allow somebody to point a gun at them or you know, get close to them with a weapon and not defend themselves or the people around them. So,
right.
You know, it really is a balance.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, it is trying to give them some other tools to utilize. So, that might not be the primary go-to.
Yeah. Probably not going to, even if we ask them to set aside their sense of safety training of if someone pointed a gun at you, well, yeah. And if that's, you know, the situation, then that's going to take over. And I think one of the benefits we have when we get away from vilification and that sort of thing, and we maybe look at things from, you know, a problem solving perspective on micro levels, and we look at them from macro levels of, you know, like, you know, there are bad apples, or we can look at it like that, but really there are also, you know, products of the system, whether it's the people in crisis that the police are responding to, whether it's the police mm-hmm. themselves and maybe their upbringing and culture and values, it all comes crashing down. And the more we allow ourselves to create a space for empathy and to understand, you know, not only personally, but acknowledge, you know, history and societal factors as well, that's when we are able to pursue policies and relationships that can help us form a better society with maybe a little less violence, a little less crisis, and maybe a little more connectedness. And
absolutely.
It's hard. That's really what it comes down to. It's hard.
It is hard, and you know, we all have a personal responsibility in that, and you're right, you know, I mean, we all have our own experiences that we bring to any situation, and whether that be, you know, I mean, the families that we grew up in, the cultures that we were raised in, you know, how those things shape our perspectives, and, you know, and then you get into those individual experiences, and maybe it's a little too social worky for cops, but you know, I mean, I talk about, like, you bring a certain energy to any interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, if you are walking into a hospital thinking, you know, this pain in the ass hospital, they never want to help anybody,
right.
Because, you know, there's been certain staff that have been rude to you in the past. You know, it's probably not going to end well. It's probably not going to have a very good outcome. And similarly, the nurse who sees the cop walking in with somebody is pissed off because they've had to deal with rude cops in the past who just mm-hmm. wanted to dump people on them. Mm-hmm. And
then it all cycles over.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So really taking ownership of what is my responsibility here? What is my role? You know, how do I contribute to this? And, you know, in every single interaction, using that as an opportunity to kind of build that bridge and reshape somebody's idea of social workers, of law enforcement, of mental health providers in general, of hospitals, because we all have a role in it.
Right.
And so we get to choose.
Yeah.
We get to choose.
Right. Fascinating, just overall conversation. I want to be respectful of your time and you know, this could probably continue, but I appreciate your insights and some of the work and the processes and the situations that you are involved in to sort of try to and solve this awareness problem, among other things. You know, I think it's impressive and I admire your involvement and your work in that. Before I let you go off the podcast, there's a mandatory coping skills rule. So you're literally not allowed to hang up until you share with the listening audience things you do, because our work, and, you know, maybe kind of an understatement, requires us to be able to decompress, to manage our stress level, or we burn out and we quit and we are bitter and maybe unhealthy. So,
Yeah, how clean does this have to be?
Right. It doesn't, I mean, well, you know, like I said, this isn't being recorded live, so we'll just see what happens.
Sure, right? You know, so on my unhealthiest of days, you know, I drink whiskey and drop a lot of F-bombs.
Yeah, yeah, and that is extremely cathartic, you know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, sometimes you just gotta get it out, and hey, the same goes for coping skills and dealing with my children. So,
right. Well,
you know, there's some crossover there.
Yeah, I mean, drinking whiskey and swearing out loud is a coping skill, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. You know, I mean, on a more serious note, I suppose, for me, just like I'm such an external processor that being able to just let it out with some of my coworkers is so helpful for me. And I, you know, I have a small group of them at the office, but then because of the uniqueness of my role, you know, I'm in some ways I feel more connected to the officers than I do some of the people in our office, simply because I'm with them more and we're out on those calls. And, you know, I see what those calls are like for them as well. And gosh, we could have a whole nother, you know, hour plus long discussion about, you know, just the wellness side of things for us and for them, especially for them. But, just being able to, you know, kind of talk some of that stuff through, because you're right, it's super hard. Mm-hmm. It's super hard work. Yeah. And, you know, some things just sit differently. Gosh, since I've had kids, like working on various cases that have to deal with kids, especially, you know, cases in which children have died, like, I can just barely even stand it.
Right. I had a client this morning that a situation where their kid drowned in the bathtub in front of them.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So a situation like that, you know, we see from a care providing perspective, and we almost completely check out of that situation, you know, because it's especially as a parent, that can be fairly triggering. And you know, I'm thinking, oh, I got to get back home and love on my son a little bit. I can't even be present right now, you know, like those kinds of things.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the other thing for me personally, my faith is huge. I mean, that is something that totally helps get me through. So being able to acknowledge that, hey, for one thing, I don't have the corner market on helping people. There's other people in this world who are amazing, compassionate, empathetic people who want to help. And so I am not everyone's savior. I'm not anyone's savior. Let's be clear about that. So I have to, you know, really acknowledge my own limitations, but then being able to, you know, fall back on that spiritual aspect of it and say, you know, okay, I can really be in prayer about this and hope that, you know, God's going to provide some other people to come around them. You know, maybe we're just planting a seed here for them, and, you know, God's going to provide some other avenues, some other people or situations who are going to help really grow that and cultivate that seed. Having that aspect of it too has been helpful, because, you know, not at every situation, or maybe I should say most situations, they're messy. Mm-hmm. They aren't clear cut. Mm-hmm. They don't end up in a nice little box with tissue paper and a you know, pink bow tied around it. You know, I mean,
most things. Yeah.
Messy. Yes. Right. Like, I would love it if every time we got done with, you know, a certain situation, family, person, whoever it may be, you know, that it was just clear cut and we wrapped everything up all nice and neat with that bow and all the problems were solved and they weren't going to have any problems again. And so, since that like never happens,
right. Yeah.
It's been really helpful for me to have, my faith to really fall back on, to help kind of get through those unknowns, messiness, the gray areas, because that is the majority of the work.
Right. Yeah. There's, I mean, multiple depths of seeking inner resources and perhaps external resources and maybe a bottle of whiskey wrapped in a nice little bow, and it's a combination of therapies, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Like, I'm pretty sure if the fish and the loaves happened now, that Jesus would bring a bottle of whiskey as well. I mean,
well, it would be par for the course to providing wine for the whole party. So,
yeah, absolutely, right. Absolutely.
So, Jen Gentry, I appreciate you coming on to the program and sharing all the cool stuff that you're involved in. Yeah, maybe we'll have another hour-long conversation about the self-care aspect sometime.
I would love it. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for what you're doing. And just, putting a lot of information out there and getting conversations started. I mean, gosh, that's half the battle.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nate. Hey!